I was asked to introduce the moderator tonight, but I'll also present to you our panelists of distinguished governors. But the moderator is a good friend, Bill Kristol, who was my first boss when I was working for Dan Quayle. More recently, we have something else in common. It turns out that Donald Trump is not a big fan of either Bill Kristol or me. With respect to Bill, he tweeted, "Bill, your small and slightly fading magazine will be a giant success when you finally back Trump. The country will soar." I won't read to you what the Donald writes about me because there are children in the audience. But without further ado, we have an exciting panel tonight of some of the great leaders at the states. I'm going to call forward our governors, Governor Sam Brownback, Governor Nathan Deal, Governor Todd Ricketts. I'm sorry. He's a great guy. That's his brother. And Governor Scott Walker. And of course, Bill Kristol. Bill, I'm going to turn it over to you to MC our panel.
Well, thank you, David. I'm supposed to be George Will, but they decided they wanted a classy Fox Business Channel type discussion, not a CNBC type. You know, don't you, when you see CNBC, you think George Will, Don't repeat this to George. George had a family occasion that he had to take care of, so I'm happy to substitute for him. I'm happy to be here with four excellent governors and friends, and I really look forward to hearing from them about federalism is supposed to be the topic, but if they want to tell us who the Republican presidential nominee is going to be or who it should be or anything, I'm sure we'd be happy to hear that too. Let me begin by asking about, I think federalism hasn't been discussed maybe quite as much as one might have expected in the presidential race so far. I guess it's not maybe a sexy topic, but what would you tell your colleagues who are running, whether they're governors or not governors? I guess I don't know if I should begin with Scott Walker or not. I told Scott backstage that this was supposed to be the year of the governor. I don't know if that's going to be the case, but this is the evening of the governors, you know, so some consolation. But it's great. I do want to say seriously that all these four are very busy people, and it's really great that you took the time to be here. And Scott, what about federalism?
Well, first off, it is still the year of the governor, and the reason I say that is if you look at what just happened a couple of weeks ago in Kentucky.
Hear, hear.
It just goes to show that people understand that if you want to get something done, you need to elect a Republican governor. And so no matter what happens next November, and certainly I'm, as everybody on this panel, I don't know about all the rest of this audience, certainly hopes we have a Republican president after next November's election. Now I officially got more time than I did at the last debate I was in, so that's pretty good.
Well, thank you, Governor Walker. Now we can go to go.
But the reason I say that about the governors is because, and we've felt this for some time under this current president, who obviously I'm not a big fan of, but the one solace in all that the last few years is that we've had Republican governors. So we didn't just have people who were Republican who were on the ballot and ran and then just sat in office. We had Republican governors across the country who've done amazing things. And I would hope, and it may not be by the next debate, but in the next couple months, as the presidential candidates on the Republican side at least go into the early caucus and primaries in February and March of next year, that they talk about, Bill, as you said, federalism, but I would advise them not to say that phrase. Because most Americans, oddly enough, if you say federalism, they think it means more federal government, not less. Mm. simple way I would explain, ask them to explain it is simple. If you all had, I have it conveniently in my pocket, but if you had took out of your wallet or your purse a dollar, and you looked at that dollar, simple question that they should be asking the American people to make this point is, where would you rather send this dollar? Would you rather send it to Washington, where not just the Congress and the President, but more disconcerting, the bureaucrats take that dollar and send back pennies on the dollar with little or no value to your states and to your local communities, or whether would you rather keep that dollar back at home and not just your state, but your community, to go to your kids' school, to fix your local roads, to take care of the needy in the hospitals and care centers in your community. I think most people in America, not just Republicans, but I think most independents and even some discerning Democrats would rather keep that dollar back in their own communities. And I think that's a compelling argument, not just for those of us who believe in the concept of federalism, but for people who believe in common sense. And I think these days, more than anything, that's what we've got to do. We've got to get out of the bubble of Washington, get out of the bubble of some of the discussions we have at political events like this, and talk in ways that can relate to everyday Americans. I actually wish I'd done a little bit more of that before the end of September, but that's a lesson learned going forward.
Thanks. Sam, what? I mean, give an example. What one thing, if you could get one big program back under your control or away from the federal government, or one big reform, the next president calls you up and after November 8th or whatever it is and says, I can't do everything at once, but what's the first thing I should do that would really help you be a better governor of Kansas?
I'm going to answer. I got to recognize two of my heroes.
Sure it is.
Justice Scalia and Justice Alito are here, and these guys. You're just heroes to me. I mean, that's. I guess I have to yield back my time now. I don't know if that's what I have to do.
Another way to dodge your question there, Sam.
Scalia-Alito was a good ticket for 2016.
Ah. Well, we could get around to that. And then the second, this is a total cheap shot. How about the Royals this year in baseball, huh? You know, not everybody cheered for the Royals? Anyway, I'd take the poverty reduction programs back, welfare.
Yep.
We've started on that, and we've started now making work requirements. The Obama administration moved away from that. Year one, people getting off of public assistance and into a job, 50% increase in income that people are experiencing in the state of Kansas. They're moving, and we're pushing that. And these poverty programs have been terrible since the Great Society. They have put people in poverty. Paul Ryan's work in this area hard. This is a winner. It is something we should do. The left has messed this up terribly. We've spent $20 trillion roughly since the Great Society to end poverty in this country, and the level of poverty is the same as when the Great Society program started. We can do so much better, and this is the area. This is really the one I think that we should grab and do and change, and people will be better and they'll get out of poverty.
Pete, you're the newest governor on stage. So what struck you? I mean, what's different from what you expected, and particularly on this question of what would you like to have more control of? Maybe was there something you'd like to just give to the federal government on the other hand? Would you like to separate the functions more?
You know, I can't think of anything I'd like to give to the federal government. But I think that the governor's point is well taken. You know, just look at, extend that into now what's going on with healthcare and how governors have said, hey, let us try and experiment. Let us try to innovate. You know, Asa Hutchinson trying to add work requirements into his expansion for what he wanted to do down there with regard to the requirements and being told no. Because this is the big problem of why the federal government consistently fails. Because they, and by the way, this happens in Nebraska too, when we try to make rules in Lincoln that apply to the entire state, generally it's a one-size-fits-all answer that doesn't work. Only we see it at the federal government on a huge scale where you've got the federal government making rules, they got their plan, it's their way or the highway, and you have no flexibility to say, but that may work in New York, it doesn't work in Nebraska. We've got a different state, we've got different people, we've got different problems. And that's the biggest problem with what the federal government does in just about every level. And you see, you know, again, this whole Obamacare thing, it's not working. It continues, rates continue to go up. You look at what's in Nebraska, our Medicaid spending, I think in 1979, was about 2 or 3% of our budget. Now it's 19%. It's driving out all the other investments we want to make in roads or education. And I would love to start taking that back into the state. But the federal government taxes our people so much, we couldn't afford to do it because we just couldn't ask that our people to spend that much more for us to start doing it on the state level. So it really creates a huge problem for the states when the federal government tries to step in and do things that really we ought to be managing one-off because we know better how to solve the problems than they do.
Good. Governor Deal, you've been on both sides here in Washington and then now in Georgia. How different does it look from Atlanta than it did from Washington? And what would you reconsider anything you voted for here? Or, you know,
I would.
Is that right?
When you asked the question initially about federalism, I must admit that I am much more conscious of that concept as a governor than I ever was as a member of the United States House of Representatives. I suppose I wish I had been more conscious of it at that time. I think to answer the last question is, what would you take back? I think since we're here and we are theoretically talking about things, not things that we reasonably expect are going to happen, but I think the starting point would be, let's go back and look at the Constitution. Let's figure out, and they're very clear, as to what the enumerated powers of the federal government are, and leave those with the federal government. And then everything else is the repository of the people and the states. As a member of Congress, which I ran for governor and gave up my seat in Congress to be elected governor, I was the ranking Republican on the Health Subcommittee of Energy and Commerce at the time the Affordable Care Act was passed. And by the way, folks, it did not get a single Republican vote when it passed. But give you a quick example. The premise behind it was going to eliminate the uninsureds in this country. Well, we all know that has not happened. I offered an amendment in the committee that was voted down on party lines to simply say, okay, if that's your goal, why don't you exclude from coverage those people in this country who are employees of state and local governments who are covered by local and state health insurance plans? Because they're not uninsured, they are in fact insured. Well, as I say, it was voted down. This year, in our budget in Georgia, the cost of the Affordable Care Act to our state is $332.1 million just to comply with the Affordable Care Act. We're having to spend $1.8 million just to mail out the forms to the IRS certifying that everybody who's on Medicaid and everybody who's insured under our state health benefit plan actually has insurance. Now, that's how far it has gone. So what would I take back? I'd start with taking health care back.
Good start. Good one. Good start.
Yeah, Bill, I just want to expound for a second on something that Nathan just said, because I think you're right, and it's not just philosophical. I mean, I think, obviously, everybody in this room shares the sentiment that each of us as governors and Bill Kristol does, that philosophically, if you look at the Constitution, it's pretty clear. Pretty clear what's spelled out. I think as governors, we all love the Constitution, but we particularly love the 10th Amendment, which spells it out about as clear as it can be. If it isn't defined as the responsibility of the federal government, it is inherently that of the states, and more importantly, of the people. And that's an issue that's really disconnected in this town over and over and over again. But it's not just a philosophical issue. I think it's pretty practical. You ask the American people what they think and where they think the limited role of government should have in their lives, they certainly think it's a lot better at the city and at the state level than it is coming out of Washington. And so I think, Bill, to your point, the question isn't just what one thing. I think the better question we should be asking the American people to think about is, what one thing or two things do you want left in the federal government, and the rest should go back to the states and the people? Because really, it's not that, I mean, we talk about healthcare, and I agree with you all that. You think about healthcare, you think about food stamps, you think about Medicaid, but you think about education, transportation, infrastructure, dare I even say environmental protection. Why are any of those things done at the federal level when they should be done at the state level. It's pretty clear out there. It's more practical, it's more effective, it's more efficient, and it's definitely more accountable to the taxpayers if we do it at the state and the local level as opposed to coming out of Washington.
Let me ask you one question and then go around. I guess I'm struck it's supposedly such an anti-government year, and of course the two leading candidates on the Republican side now have never held elective office, and certainly presumably their appeal is partly based on a critique of how the federal government works. But that hasn't, I think it's fair to say, been translated into what you all have just said. It's an inchoate anti-federal government sentiment more than a real agenda for saying, you know, these functions should be done at the state level. These functions shouldn't be done maybe at any level of government, but should be done in civil society or by voluntary associations, et cetera. I mean, is there an opportunity for a radical agenda, a bold agenda along those lines, which hasn't quite been taken care account of, or the opportunity hasn't been seized yet this year? Or do voters not really want to hear that, and they just, I don't know, they tune it out? And I'm just curious, you were out there for months and talked to an awful lot of people. What's your sense?
Well, I think there's no doubt. I think there's no doubt whatsoever that people want to hear that. I think part of the reason why you have a couple of candidates, well, three in particular, who've never held office before that have done as well as they've done, is because voters feel like they're so frustrated with politics, they're particularly frustrated with Washington, that they're willing to give people a chance who've never held office before, particularly if they say bold, aggressive things, whether you agree with them all or not. I think there's a real frustration. They feel that people come to Washington and say one thing, and then it doesn't happen. The one thing I heard out in the campaign trail over and over again goes to the point, Nathan, you brought up with Obamacare. When I hear people say, hey, wait a minute, we were told that, you know, the House is Republican, when the Senate goes Republican, there'll be a repeal of Obamacare. And voters are pretty shrewd. I mean, people think, oh, they're, you know, superficial. They're not superficial. Voters, not just in the early states, but across the country, they say, hey, you told us, we get the president's gonna veto this, but put it on his desk. That's what we were told last year during the election. Just telling us that it's not somehow gonna happen isn't good enough. So I think there's that sentiment out there. I think people, if the connection's gotta be made to say, it's not enough to just elect a Republican president. If you really want to transform the problems that are coming out of Washington, you gotta find a way to shrink the size and scope of the government, particularly at the federal level. For what's left, where's the most appropriate place to do it? It's pretty hard not to argue that it isn't at the state and the local level. I think the candidate that has a clear plan, not just saying that, but spells out how you would do it, how you'd work with the House and the Senate to get it done, certainly can have appeal, not just in the debates, but in the larger electorate.
I was gonna say, but I think that one of the challenges you've got, if you're gonna be a candidate doing that, is that it's great to say that when you're on the campaign trail, but then if you actually get elected, if you look historically, it's been not just the president or not just the Congress or not even just the judiciary, it's been all three branches that have worked against the states. I mean, you can look at a number of different things, right? Congress passes bills that you get their federal money if you do what they say they do. The president instructs his EPA to give us backdoor cap and trade through this clean power plan, right? And the judiciary votes to take away the rights of states to decide what marriage is, right? So all three branches have worked against it. So if you're a candidate that says, hey, I'm gonna work to get state power back, how are you gonna do that? When historically your branch has been one of the problems about trying to take power away from the states, because it's that vertical separation of powers that has been getting so hammered us in the states.
Bill, I think there's gonna be a great chance for the next president, the next Republican president, the next Republican president in 2016, to really take this federalism agenda and say, okay, here's how I'm gonna do this. We're gonna send a number of these programs back to the state, and we're gonna cap the budget on this. And you could work with any of us, I think all of us would say, you send that back to me, and even if you cap the budget, and if it's slightly lower than where it is right now, I'll take it rather than having all the strings and all the things that you tell me we've got to do. And I will deliver you a better program than you're doing right now, because I can design it for Kansas better than you can from Washington for Kansas. And I think there's going to be a great opportunity for the next Republican president and Congress to really devolve a series of these based, if nothing else, on the budget and the money shortage that's here.
I hope you're right. I mean, we have about 1,200 people in this room who aspire to senior jobs in the next Republican administration.
One
of them will be Solicitor General. The other 1,199 will be deeply disappointed.
any show of hands that want to serve?
what, I mean, what practical advice? So you do have a lot of people in this room, I think, who will be at different levels, up and down, in different agencies. I came to Washington to work in the education department, and we were theoretically committed. I mean, I'd say it's very hard. You get in, and you're theoretically committed to Ronald Reagan ran on abolishing the Department of Education. Bill Bennett proposed huge cuts to the budget of the Department of Education. Congress refused to accept them, of course, the first couple of times we proposed them. Then we decided, well, basically, we're here anyway. It's kind of irresponsible not to do anything, so we'll use it as a bully pulpit. And while we're using it as a bully pulpit, maybe it'd be good to have some demonstration programs, and maybe it'd be good to have some research, and maybe some incentives for some good things. And suddenly, I suspect we ended up, I've never had the nerve to go, I don't really want to go back and look at it, but you know, increasing the number of federal regulations coming out of the Education Department rather than decreasing them. It's a very natural thing to happen. And I guess it is a question for the next presidents and next cabinet secretaries and general counsels of agencies and so forth, if they really are serious about limiting the federal government, how to sort of make that incentive for the actual people working in the federal government. And then there's Congress also, so.
Yeah. Well, Bill, let me make an observation. I think that what we're seeing play out in the presidential side of things on the Republican side is that the people of this country really don't believe that some of the things that some candidates say they're going to do can actually be done. We have become a society so dependent on entitlement programs, so engulfed in what are you going to do for me, that many people don't think that big things can happen. Sam and I were in Congress in the early 90s, and I recall vividly that nobody ever thought you could reform welfare. That was just one of those impossible tasks. You could never do it. Well, we had to send it to President Clinton three times before he finally signed it, but he saw what the public thought about it, a big idea that had at least gotten and moved to his desk. He vetoed it twice. He finally signed it because the 96 presidential election was coming along. And John Kasich, our former colleague, being the chairman of the Budget Committee, when he reminds people, I'm not sure they really it sinks in. He says, we actually balanced the budget in 1998. It had not been balanced in about 40 years. It was one of those things that we'd given up on. That's an impossible idea. So when a candidate today says, we need to reform welfare, oh, well, you know, that was tried and we've gotten away from the reforms, which this administration has definitely gotten away from what was put in place in the early 90s. When they say it's time we balanced our federal budget, the media in particular just dismisses that. That's a unacceptable, unrealistic expectation. Well, it's not. But if we let ourselves fall into that pattern of thinking that it is also impossible and it's only a campaign promise that will never be fulfilled, we have undercut the things that we really believe in.
Bill, if I could jump on that. In this room, people should be working on those plans right now, because this is a lot of the smart people in Washington, D.C., that you know these issues, but don't lose hope. I think that's what Nathan's saying, is just don't lose hope that, yes, we can, and not only can we've got to. How many of you are desperately worried about the direction of this country? I mean, honestly, how many of you are desperately worried about it? And you know, and you can just cry about it. There's days I want to just cry about it. Sometimes I have. But that isn't the right answer. The answer is to take the ship back. And then when you get it, let's do something different with this. Let's get it going the right direction. And you need to be working on these plans now, because your first 100 days in office, and certainly no more than your first year, is when you have the maximum political authority to be able to move something. You know that. You know that's the period of time that you have. And so if these plans aren't ready before this election is over, it is unlikely you're going to be able to get it done when you have the authority to do it. And these things need to be being developed and put together now. And it can happen. I believe it will. And we better be ready when we get our chance, because you don't get those to come along that often.
Well, Sam's right, and it's not only the right thing to do, it's the politically wise thing to talk about as well. Why do people want some of these outsiders, or why are they at least attracted to them now? Because they're the people that are saying the things that we say all across America in bars and taverns, but don't think anybody has the guts to do. So we need to have leaders up there. We need to reaffirm the leaders of our party as governors, in particular, and all of you who share these same sentiments out there, that go out and say, not just I'm going to settle for a waiver here or a waiver there. No, we need to fundamentally shift the size and scope of the federal government. We need to dream big. You know, it's what's the KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid. I mean, keep it right to the focus of what people believe, and they believe that Washington's the best. One of the lines I used to get the best applause from when I said that Washington, D.C. is 68 square miles surrounded by reality. And people get that. They're frustrated with it. They're upset with that. And so the idea about transferring power, I think, is fundamentally important out there because they want people to make that shift. And we've got to make that case. We've got to fundamentally make that case going forward. I just think the louder we proclaim that, and anybody who says, oh, you know, we can't do that, we got to be incremental, Bill, you're right about how some of the sentiment in the past. I think people in America are hungry for transformational change. Not just for a new party, not just for somebody different in a different party than the other, but leaders, not just the president. I mean, think about it. We got Paul Ryan. I'm biased being a cheesehead, but I think Paul Ryan could be one of the most consequential speakers in the history of this country. Someone who's not... someone who's not only politically astute and a good communicator, but I think someone who is deeply committed to reform. Senator Lee knows this. The Senate, with the class that just came in last year, you've got some dynamic folks, and it's exciting to think about that, and hopefully Republicans will be able to add to that. And then if we have a leader in the next president who's committed to reform, anybody who says it can't be done, I come from a state that hasn't gone Republican for president since 1984. I was in high school back then. That's the last time my state's gone Republican for president, yet we, not only did I win three elections in 4 years, in 10, and the recall on again, not expected, but oftentimes in the national discussion about that, they forget it wasn't just me, our majorities in the state legislature that were all Democrat before I took office after the 2010 election, went from all Democrat to all Republican, gained seats in 12, and gained seats again in 2014 in a state that has more Democrats than Republicans. Why? Because early in 2011, we did what people said couldn't be done. I remember in my own cabinet even sitting looking out the window of our Capitol, and we were talking about the budget crisis that was pending on the horizon out there, and they said, we need to nibble around the edges a little here, a little there, and I looked out the window and said, why are we looking inside here? Why don't we just change collective bargaining? Why do we need to say, and they said, well, you can't do that, it's the law. And I said, don't we make the laws? And all these light bulbs went on around all the people in my office, like, aha, we actually do that. But I say that because sometimes I think in this city, for those of us who believe in the Constitution, who believe in the people of this country, we sometimes settle for what we think is possibly achievable. We live in a minority mindset that somehow it's just good enough to make incremental change. That's not what Americans are looking for. The reason why there's a bunch of outsiders leading the Republican pack is because Americans are sick and tired of incremental change. They want leadership in this city that's going to transform this country.
I'm impressed by Scott's energy and morale, and the Packers, after the last two horrible weekends for the Packers, it's amazing that you're in such good
frustration
shape.
Frustration from the Packers.
So Scott, I agree with what both you and Sam have said about, we want that transformational leader as our president. I agree 100%. And I'm actually gonna go play devil's advocate and take it one step farther, okay? So I'm gonna say that's all great, that we should have that transformational leader, we should strive to get that person. But fundamentally, the incentives are set up against, that's the system, okay? Think about, you know, prior to the Great Depression, most of the spending done in this country was done at the state and local level. And then with the Great Depression, that flipped with the big programs, okay? And it's been going the wrong way ever since. And that's because whoever has the gold makes the rules. And that's why states have continued to lose power. So yes, we should get a president, but the president is part of the office of the president is part of the problem. The Congress is part of the problem. The Supreme Court has been part of the problem. We need to fundamentally rethink how we're going to look at this Constitution to give states' rights back. I mean, you know, as a state, if we don't like what the federal government's doing, we can take them to court. And sometimes we win, and sometimes we don't. You know, Nebraska was part of the lawsuit that sued the EPA on waters in the U.S. We got a judge to give us a stay for just our 13 states, and then another judge issued it for the rest of the country. That's a start of a win, right? That's a great start. And again, this is, you say, why does that have to do with federalism? Well, the 1972 Clean Water Act said EPA has authority over navigable waters. Now they want to do it, apparently, anything that gets wet. You know, like ponds, roadside ditches, water, you know, it could be on a field or something like that. Those are state issues. That's not a federal issue. That's a state issue. So we can take them to court, and sometimes we may win, but the system itself has been working against us because the federal government is so big and spends so much money. So even if you get that transformational president, the system itself, the inertia in the system, is driving us toward more and more federal power all the time. How do we fundamentally, like, we could, and states should continue to sue the federal government, you know, trust me, in Nebraska, we got a great attorney general, we will continue to do that. But we got to think about what are the other things we as states can do to be able to fight back and create a balance of power here with the government that we created, right? The states created the federal government, not the other way around. So I'm going to issue the challenge to all of you here tonight. You're all a bunch of smart people. What do we do? How do you advise us as states or as a collection of states so that we can get back that power from the federal government? What do we need to do? What do we need to come together and change so that we can establish a true balance of power with the federal government and remind the federal government we created it, not the other way around? We should be the ones setting the rules, not them. Because until we figure that out, we're going to, even with the best of intentions, with a great Congress, with a great president, with a great Supreme Court, the inertia in the system will continue to drive all the power to the federal government because that's who's spending the money.
Anyone have an answer up here?
My view is actually contrary to that. Because of the money, the federal budget deficit is so large, right. The entitlement obligation is so high, that I believe we're getting to that point where the federal government doesn't have the money and isn't going to have the money. And if you bring in a responsible Republican administration that decides we're actually going to try to be cognizant of how much money is spent, you've got to devolve it to the states. And it'll be because of the money that this will happen.
But we've seen historically, what did we say the last budget was? When was the last balanced budget?
98.
Yeah, I mean, historically, that just isn't being borne out, even with good Republican presidents.
I know, and it's like Wile E. Coyote chasing the roadrunner, you know, when he always runs off the cliff and he keeps running, it's in air. I think we've been running on air for a while. At some point in time, you do have to pay the piper on this.
Well, yeah, but the federal government can print its own money.
Yeah. And at some point in time, you get a series
of... Right, we're
the
ones that are going to pay the price for that, right?
Yeah, you're going to get high inflation or something at some point in time. You just can't keep doing this. And I do think it would be responsible of the Republican administration to change that.
I mean, I do
well,
think...
Well, and not just to the next president administration, but on this point, I mean, I'm going to just lay it right out there. Not everybody here is a Republican, but I'm a Republican. We're each of the panelists, the governors are Republicans.
I'm not sure about Crystal.
if America...
They're
elects,
a bunch of squishy Republicans. I'm a conservative, not a Republican.
I told you.
Mike Lee is nodding.
if America elects a Republican president, certainly, the odds statistically are much higher to return to Republican House, and hopefully with a couple key races, like sending my friend Ron Johnson back to the United States Senate from Wisconsin, a few other key races around the country. But if, as Republicans, we don't do the very things I just talked about after the next election, as much as I'm proud to be a Republican, the American people will have every right to throw us out of office. That's the reason why I brought up what we said in Wisconsin, and we're not alone. There's a number of states that have done dynamic things over the last couple of years, particularly in states. The reason why I mentioned Wisconsin is because we went from all Democrat to all Republican. This is why this is so important. I remember the week after the election. The election was November 2nd, 2010. The week after, we went into our Capitol and met with all the Republicans. They were picking the next speaker, the next Senate leader, and it was an open caucus. I should have thought about this being the headline the next day, but because it was. But I said it is put up or shut up time. said the voters went from all Democrat to all Republican in our state. If they made that sort of transformational change, and if we just nibble around the edges, the voters will have every right to throw us out of office. It is put up or shut up time. And the reason why I tell you about our experience in Wisconsin is we did it. We did exactly what I said we should do. And then the voters sent not only me, but increased majorities in each of our houses back in the 12 and 14 election, and even in a state that historically has gone more Democrat than Republican. If we can do that in individual states across the country, there's no reason. And Pete, you're right. There is a huge tidal wave of pressure going the opposite direction here, which is why we're going to have a limited window after this next election to make that kind of transformational change. Because if we don't, not only are Republicans going to be in office, but there's going to be this whole wave to go even further the other direction. So it's one of those, we always talk about how big elections are, but I think it really is. Everything's aligned, not just House Republicans, but Paul and I grew up down the road from each other. We both worked at McDonald's as kids. The only difference is his manager told him he had to work the back flipping hamburgers because he didn't have the interpersonal skills to work the French cash register. It's true. I love this even more being able to tell us about the Speaker of the House of Representatives. He was in Janesville, I was in Delaware, both at McDonald's. But when you think about Paul there, when you think about this great new wave, not just this last class, but Mike and some of the others who are in the Senate, people who are really ready not just to be Republicans, but to be reformers. If we miss our opportunity, I mean, we're blowing it not just for ourselves, we're blowing it for our children, and that's just unacceptable.
I mean, I suppose one thing that's I think Pete makes a very important point and something that's really worth thinking about, which is the more fundamental in a way constitutional reforms that might be possible or necessary, but on the big incremental side, let's say. I mean, every Republican presidential candidate wants to repeal and replace Obamacare. I think almost all the replace proposals have sending Medicaid back to the states. I don't think it's conceivable that someone would get elected president running on that platform and not genuinely seek to repeal and replace Obamacare. Presumably there'd be a Republican House and maybe probably a Republican Senate that might help with that. So you could have one of the biggest transfers back, I guess, I'm just thinking out loud here, of a huge federal program to the states. Not that people are talking exactly about the federalism side of the repeal of Obamacare, but it would have a big, wouldn't it, a big federal effect. And the other thing that strikes me, just looking at the election, I mean, Common Core is a bigger issue, I think, and maybe wrong about this, than people think.
It is.
And I don't think that's because of the details of Common Core. It's because of a sense that, unfortunately, we never did succeed in curbing the Education Department, even under Republican presidents, and now it's really imposing things on the states and other localities, which also suggests to me that a fairly bold sending really getting the federal government out of education, except for some very limited things, that would be attractive, I should think, in the early. So if you did two pretty big things like that, I think maybe the dynamic would sort of change. I really wonder, I was just, again, thinking of this interesting discussion. Welfare reform was 96, and I remember we all thought at the time, this is kind of a, and then it was successful. And then there was a recession in 2001, and it did not lead to people starving on the streets and so forth, the people, the worries that the critics articulated. But it had no follow-on. Some historian will write an interesting, maybe someone already has, Kristen Muth probably knows, a book on this, or some political scientist. Why weren't there follow-on efforts to welfare reform? And in fact, the first thing the Bush administration did in 01, really in domestic policy, the first big thing was No Child Left Behind, which I think really cut in the other direction, no? So in a way, maybe you could argue the last time a Republican administration came into Washington, it didn't push in the direction that you all are arguing. In fact, it sort of undercut what momentum there was in that direction. Maybe that wouldn't be the case if Obamacare, education, and some other issues are central. Nathan?
Let me change the direction of the discussion just a minute.
Please.
We're all Republican governors. We have now, 32 Republican governors in this country?
Yep.
What we can do at the state level is to set the example. We can show the people what Republican principles can actually accomplish. And I think that's incumbent on all of us to do that. When I first became governor after the 2010 election, in my first state address, I brought up a subject that people said, that's not a Republican subject. Why are you talking about criminal justice reform? And my answer was, well, first of all, because it's costing us about $1.2 billion to run our correction system, and we have the highest incarceration rate. We're having a recidivism rate that is about one out of every three that's released coming back within 3 years or less. And we started a systematic 3-year program of criminal justice reform. I think it has proven to be the most successful reform in the entire country. We started by diverting nonviolent offenders, adult offenders, into accountability courts, drug courts, DUI courts, mental health courts, veterans courts. We have seen our prison population drop as a result of that by about 3,000 at this point in time. We're seeing people being given the chance to redeem their lives. We then went to the juvenile system, because if you think it's expensive to pay $18,000 to $19,000 a year to incarcerate an adult, it was costing us about $91,000 a year to incarcerate a juvenile. And we went with juvenile reform. It too has seen significant reforms. We're now working on those about 53,000 who are in our prison system. We did a survey. The most common characteristic was they dropped out of school. About 7 out of every 10 did not have a high school diploma or GED. So we're focusing on giving them a skill. If they have a skill when they get released and they're paroled, they'll be less likely to come back into our system. Now, what has happened as a result of that is we are now seeing in our population as a whole people who would never embrace a Republican idea saying, you know, that was the thing to do. And Republicans did it, because we had Republican control of the House and the Senate and the governorship, of course. And I think what we can do at the state level is to set those kinds of examples to convince the people that conservative principles can work. I think it's a little ironic now that this administration, some 5 years after we took it on, has now decided that criminal justice reform is an important thing for the federal government to do. Maybe if they would follow the example of states on a lot of other things, like balancing our budgets, maybe it would work for them as well.
I agree with that, Bill. I think Nathan's spot on. You change America by changing states. Don't change America by changing Washington, because states can then innovate, and then you can migrate the concept. When I first came into Congress with David McIntosh, 94, class of 94, first Republican Congress in over 40 years. I mean, we did welfare reform that Nathan was talking about. That was because Michigan and Wisconsin had already done it at the state level, and so we had a model to be able to follow. Remember that, David, that we're looking at studying. We bring those governors in all the time saying, how'd you do that? We do that on criminal justice. We went to zero income taxes on small business, on LLC and sub S pass-through, as a way to get growth taking place in our economy. And we now have a record number of small businesses filing in the state of Kansas, and people moving into the state of Kansas, small businesses moving in. One of the things we need to do in this country is get small business growing. We're losing small businesses. We're not even growing them. We're losing small businesses in the country, and that's where your growth is. Our state, it's 65-70% of people work for themselves or for somebody else with 10 or fewer employees. I mean, those are the sort of things that you can then grab and move up. It's just, I want to implore you again, we're going to have to move fast, because your political power will dissipate quickly to do these sort of things.
You should tell your senators and congressmen from all your different states that, I was thinking about the welfare example. I remember in 95, we started the weekly standard then. John Engler from Michigan and Tommy Thompson from Wisconsin were here all the time.
They were.
Testifying formally before House and Senate committees, informally meeting
caucuses.
The Republican conference, and not just Republicans, maybe meeting with Democrats, doing press things. I would say the Republican House, which has now been in Republican control for, 4.5 years, and the Senate, which now is Republican, has done very little of that. I mean, there are 32 Republican governors. I don't know how many times you guys have testified or come to Washington to make a case, but my impression is it's not the way it was when Gingrich took over and Dole was leader, and there really was a sustained effort to say, well, we have some success stories in the states. How do we help them at the state level and replicate them at the federal level? So maybe you could get those senators and congressmen from Kansas and Nebraska and Georgia and Wisconsin to really think a little bit about
that. Maybe somebody from Wisconsin knows the speaker.
Nah. I don't know. Is he on good terms with the speaker or not?
Just gave away his whole McDonald's story.
Yeah, that could be fair. Right. Well, Paul Ryan does know that, and Paul Ryan was a staffer on the Hill, actually, in 95, and has thought a lot about that. But
in the Brownback
Mike Lee
office,
has tried to do
he was
some
in
others,
my office.
And he worked for Sam.
He was in my office, in the House and in the Senate. I've got a better Paul Ryan story than you, though. we kicked him out of a staff meeting one time. So we were meeting on Saturday morning. Paul's a deer hunter. And he comes in, he's sitting around the room. He'd been deer hunting, and then comes in for the staff meeting. And somebody goes, "What's that smell?" Anyway, he had put something of deer on him.
Oh, yeah.
And we kicked him out of the staff meeting, you know, for that. No. Good, wholesome guy.
No, you want to have
Is this on C-SPAN? I hope not.
You really want to have fun tonight. I can top that.
Oh, you can top that one?
Paul and I have been knowing each other for years, and Paul is better looking than I am, but we're about the same height, look the same in many ways, height-wise, and people often get us confused on airplanes. We fly the same routes out of Milwaukee. In fact, I'm on the red-eye tomorrow morning on the way back. Paul and I have done that route for years, so it's oftentimes people will get confused, particularly flight attendants, and they'll say to me, "Oh, you're Paul Ryan." I say, "No, I'm Scott Walker," vice versa. So a year ago, this last spring, Paul's on a flight. Flight attendant comes up to him. She's doing that, "I know who you are." And he's saying, "Okay, here it comes. I know who you are. You're Anthony Weiner." Wait. It gets better. Paul says to her, "No, I'm Scott Walker."
I think I've now lost control of this panel. It's good. Other issues? Healthcare?
You started off in control, Bill, so that's the important part.
What's that?
I said you started off in control. That's the important
part. That's right. So other issues. I mean, so I think healthcare is huge, Obamacare is huge, Medicaid is probably the federalizing part of that. Education, I think there would be quite a lot of momentum to really devolve K-12 stuff pretty thoroughly back to the states and localities. Give me some other transportation. Didn't they just pass some huge transportation bill that is not actually federalist in intention or in effect?
We were talking about EPA, a number of the provisions about there, the Clean Power Plan, we call it the Costly Power Plan. It's just one of many examples, but it's one of those where you got to think big. And not just talk to the presidential candidates, talk to people running for the House, talk to the people running for the Senate, get their commitments, get it in their mind now so they're making commitments now. Because EPA is a good example. I mean, you really think about it. Sometimes people in the city are shocked when I say this, but think about it. There are 50 states that have equivalents of the EPA. We all call it something different. In my state, it's Department of Natural Resources. Some call it that, some call it other things. But we do things that take care of clean air, clean land, clean water. We do that every single day. Why do we need a federal government to do the same thing? If anything, thank you. It's one of those, when you think about the question I asked before about what should there be left, really the federal government's responsibilities are to deal with other countries, to protect us from our enemies, and to mediate disputes over intercompact things or interstate issues, really? I mean, there's not a whole lot more. So why not say, with the environmental protection entity that we have, let's limit it to saying we're gonna deal with compacts so that if we have, like we do on our western shore in Wisconsin, the Mississippi or the Great Lakes or other things, we'll deal with mediating that, compacts between the various states that deal with those bodies of land or water or air. But let's leave the actual enforcement of those laws up to the states. Now that's a pretty dramatic change from where we've been in the past, but that's the kind of mindset we need, not just our next president, but certainly the men and women who are gonna serve as a part of his cabinet and administration, which apparently proved Bill's comments, probably a lot of people here if it's a Republican, but also those members of the House and Senate who need to think now, not just after the election, but need to think about now, what are they willing to do? What are they willing to commit to now? It's a lot easier to hold people accountable to something they talked about in the campaign than to go lobby them for something after the fact if they didn't have it brought up during the campaign. So it's incumbent upon all of you here and others that you know across the country to reach out to not just candidates for president, but the candidates for the House and the Senate to say, this is important, what are you gonna do about it?
Bill, I've got one. Sam. You asked earlier, is there something we would send back to the federal government?
Yeah.
And I've got one, the Gitmo detainees. That they're trying to send out across the states. They've been looking at different rigs. They're looking at one in Kansas at Fort Leavenworth. We are going to fight that tooth and nail. Guantanamo Bay is a fine facility to handle this very difficult problem. We're going to fight it the whole way, as is the governor of South Carolina. We've been talking about this. I mean, this is one of those things the federal government should be taking care of instead of trying to push off on us.
Find agreement there. It's like, congratulations, you won the World Series and you're getting the Gitmo detainee. It's
No, we won the World Series, and we're not getting the Gitmo detainees.
Well, I was just going to piggyback on what Scott was saying about the EPA, because it's a great example of how the federal government is really infringing upon states' rights. In particular, in Nebraska, we've got clean air, and we've got clean water. We're the largest irrigated state in the country. We know how important it is to take care of our natural resources. Agriculture is the lifeblood of our economy. It's 25% of our state GDP. We get it. We got to have a clean environment, or we're not going to be successful. And yet the EPA, even though we've got some of the cleanest air in the country, is trying to get us to reduce our carbon emissions by 40%. And they're picking on us the worst, which will ultimately, if this rule goes forward, drive up our utility costs. And we're a public power state, so we're representing ratepayers directly. And again, it's just a way that the federal government is trying to get through regulation what they could not get through legislation. And that's part of the frustration, which is why, you know, if we get rid of the EPA, I agree with you. You know, send that back to the states. We're going to do a good job because we get why it's important. And we're going to come up with solutions that are going to work for our state rather than a one-size-fits-all answer like they're trying to push on us with this clean power plant or Waters of the U.S. or anything else that the EPA is doing where they've got an agenda.
Well, and Pete, the way you explain that's a great example of how we need to be talking about that, because a lot of times when the concept, again, I'll say this word just for our purposes here, federalism comes up, we often talk about it, particularly here on panels like this and cities like this, about it from a philosophical standpoint. And again, I love the 10th Amendment, but you got to tell people what it means in their lives. It's not just about being true to our founding principles, which for me, and I imagine all of you here, is important enough in and of itself, but what does it mean to people's lives? What it means is what Pete just talked about. Why would we not want environmental protection to be done by the people who live in our own towns and communities, not by somebody out here in Washington? So you got people who have to balance both the need to have clean air, clean land, and clean water, and also the probability that our children someday will not only have those assets, but have the probability of having a job. Those are things that can be better done at the state and the local level, and in all these areas, in education, in transportation, in infrastructure, in power. I mean, there's just so many places within the federal government where power is concentrated, and you think about it, why? It didn't start out that way, not just with our founders, but it's only been in relatively recent times that we've seen this concentration of power within the federal government. It's almost like, you know, the old story about, you know, how do you boil a frog? You boil it slowly, and it's the point it realizes it's boiling, it can't get out because it's adapted to its surroundings. That's how we are as Americans. We have slowly allowed the power to shift from the people, and indirectly from the state and local governments, to the federal government. And what it's going to take is something abrupt to get out of that pot that's boiling to get us back on track again. And that's why, again, this election, not just for president, but for anybody who's on the ballot, particularly for those who want to head to Washington, is just so critically important. And we can't just talk about it at dinners like this. We got to go out and talk to our neighbors. We got to talk about it. Feel free to borrow that idea I brought at the beginning of taking a dollar out. Because when you ask people where would they rather spend it, I dare say I think there's not an American out there, other than maybe Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, who don't think that dollar is better spent at their kid's school, on their own streets, at the hospital down the block, taking care of their neighbor and loved one, than it would be sending it out to Washington.
I feel like we should end up, let you make final comments, but I feel like I should ask the final question. You know, what level of the government should we regulate fantasy football? At the federal level, at the federal level or the state level? That's my, you know, that was the pressing question of the debate a couple of weeks ago. You know, final comments, what should people take away? Nathan.
Since we're thinking out loud, and this is a great thinking group here, let's think about what we've just all sort of said in various ways. One is, we're filing suit, and we're one of those states that, along with Nebraska, that just got the stay. Congress is passing laws, but because the nature and subject matter of what the law deals with is so broad, they can't put all the details in the statute. So they delegate the authority to fill in the blanks to the executive branch agencies, and they do it, whether it be EPA or all of the other executive branch agencies. And then when those regulations and rules come out, we're dissatisfied with them. We've had no say-so in the process of the origination of them. Now, you can say we have comment periods and all of that, but we know about how far that gets you in terms of changing the direction of a bureaucracy. Why not, if we're going to pass broad statutes, why don't we delegate the authority back to the states to promulgate the rules and regulations for the enforcement of that statute for their state? If it's something that you want more than one state, I think the Republican Governors Association could take it on for 32 states. We could come out with rules and regulations that would be much more practical, and it wouldn't get us in this posture of passing a statute, having rules and regulations written, and then either Congress having to go back and re-legislate to undo the rules and regulations, or the states having to file suit because the regulations are an overreach of what Congress intended in the first place. We could simplify the process. Maybe that's the way we ought to look at it.
Interesting. Final thoughts?
Just
Sam?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. And I want to end on just two quick thoughts. One is thank you, Federal Society.
The winner of the World Series gets to close. Though, can I say this has all been, aren't the Kansas City Royals in Missouri? I mean, if I could just be.
Well, technically.
Ouch.
This is like, my bitterness as a Mets fan is coming out now. You know,
right? Yeah, well, it's a little detail. Never what, thanks to the Federalist Society. I've been tracking and working with people at the Federalist Society for many years. You're wonderful. You've done great things for this country. I think this meeting used to be in a much smaller room when I was first becoming a lawyer. And so really thank you for what you've stood for. And I do think we're coming up to a key time for you. Keep it coming. And just second, just pray for your country and pray for this time. I mean, there are a lot of people out there really concerned about what's happening in this nation. I mean, deeply concerned. And they're depending on you. They really are. They aren't here, and they're not in this town. But they're really worried about what's happening, and they're really worried about their country. And so it's dependent upon you, this nation of 310, 15 million people, that we start getting this thing right. It's very important.
On that note, thank you, governors. Thank all of you.
Scott
Walker is going to insist on the last.
No, I'm going to.
He's been watching Governor Kasich a lot, so he's like, go ahead.
I'm going to be shameless here, and I know all of you here wouldn't be here if you didn't believe in the Constitution, you didn't believe in people who support the Constitution. We talked a lot about candidates who are going to be up on the ballot next year in the fall of 2016. I was proud earlier this year to appoint to the Wisconsin Supreme Court someone who believes in the Constitution, Rebecca Bradley is a new member of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, but in Wisconsin, the governor appoints, but there are elections. No, I'm not making a campaign appeal. I'm just letting you know there are elections this spring, and the left is targeting Rebecca Bradley, who's now an incumbent member of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Take note of that.
Thank you all.